start on our way here to get going. There's the wrong passage listed in the bulletin for today. It's the one listed for last week. The actual text is in Luke 20, the parable of the wicked husbandman. And that is in Luke 20, verses 9 to 19. Now, this is after the entry into Jerusalem, which occurs in chapter 19 of Luke. And then in 20, and this occurs in all the Gospels, you might say all of the major leadership groups take a run at Jesus for the last time. The scribes, the Pharisees, and so on, and try to trap him or argue him down. And, you know, they can't, of course, especially with that thing, you know, by what authority do you do things? And, of course, he backs them into a corner by saying, you tell me about the authority of John. And that's 1 to 8 of chapter 20. Now we have 9 to 19. 9 to 19. Erxata, and he began proston laon legain to say to the people the parable, this one. Notice the Semitic word order. Now, I found this interesting. I hadn't ever noticed this before. But you notice that it says here, and I don't think the other Gospels have this. I checked briefly. I don't think they do. It says here that he said to the people. In the other ones, it's just that he says to them, which is more or less the leaders. But this time he's saying it to the people. Anthropos tis, a certain guy, some guy, ephitoisen, planted an ampelona. Ampelona is a vineyard. And ex edeta auton, and gave it out, put it out, to Georgois, guy's name George, farmers. George is the word, Georgos is the word for farmer. And ap edemesen went away, chronus hikanus, for a sufficient or a large amount of time. Now this is real interesting. When I was doing this in preparation for today, I had used my old 21st edition of Nestle, and they have ex edota, and this has ex edeta, which is real interesting, and neither one has a variant there. Now, there's got to be a problem here someplace, and we have actually a different form, you know? But this would be an improper form. Ex edota would be the kind of correct form, edomain, edu, edota. You have the da there with the endings right on. And this would be ex edeta, would be assimilated really to other forms where you have an epsilon before the ta, almost as if it's a connecting vowel. See, but it, with the old me verbs, of course, there are no connecting vowels. You just put the mai sai tai, main saw ta, right onto the stem, which is da. But this kind of got assimilated. This is the old regardless, irregardless problem. So ex edota is a little bit of an unusual form, and the more normal form would be ex edota, third person singular, aorist, indicative, middle. And, you know, the middle is... when you do something like rent out, sell, something like that, those kinds of words are always in the middle. By the way, notice also the auton in that verse, which, if you didn't know the context, you would be inclined to translate that as him, but ampelon is masculine, so you have to say it, because it's referring back to ampelon. Then the last thing I wanted to observe is chronus hikanus. There's a good example of the accusative of extent of time for a sufficient, a long amount of time. And kairo, Now we switch to the dative of point of time. It's very nice how this works. And at, on a kairos, on at a specific appointed time, ap estylen, he sent, notice apostello, he sent with a commission. See, this is a little bit more than pempo here. Got to observe that this isn't just pempo. He sent with a commission to the guy's name George, a doulon, a slave, in order that from the fruit of the vineyard, dosusin auto, they will give to him. Now, I want you to look at the variant reading there. I don't know if the unapproved text has a variant there, but the Nestle text does. And of course, that's in verse 10. You can predict that instead of dosuse, it will be dosin. Why? Because that's the subjunctive, dosin. And dosuse is a future, but you don't use a future after a hina clause, or in a hina clause. Now, this would be a perfect example, again, of the regardless, irregardless sort of situation where the text is kind of being smoothed out by the variant. That is to say, it's more grammatical. Dosusin reflects the way stuff happened in the papyri. So he sent them a slave in order that they might give to him, give something to him, from the fruit of the vineyard. Hoi de, Georgoi, and the farmers, ex ap estylon auton, sent him out back, dirantes kenon. Now, dero is a liquid verb, dero, dero, edirat, which means to flay, like to beat with sticks. So they sent him back kenon. Last word, empty, having flayed him. I want you to notice how the Greek does this, very typical, where it puts the auton, it drops the auton in between apostello and dero, dirantes, see? Sent him, not sent him flaying empty, but sent him empty, flaying him, sent, flaying, like that. Having flayed him. Well, see, I was just going to comment on that. I think so. I think what it is they're sending them back with a message. Yeah, yeah. I think it's interesting that they don't use pempo for something like that. Right, I think that this is their response. Right. 11. Kai, now I want you to watch this here. This is a very unusual construction coming up, which is extremely Hebraic. Pros etheta heteron pempsai doulon. And he did again, he added to it to send another slave. Now, pros tithemi is used in this kind of context. Andy can tell you the exact thing. The Hebrew is like haya or something like that, where you use this for to do again. This is a total Hebraism here. So it is not he added in addition another one to send a slave. It doesn't mean that. It means he added in addition to send. That is to say, he did again. He added another instance of it to send another slave, and they, hoi de, the other guys, also that one, having flayed, and atimasantes, timadzo, to dishonor, and having dishonored him, sent him out back empty. 12. And pros etheta, we got that same construction again, pempsai, to send a third. And they, also this one, traumatisantes. Well, you can see our word trauma from that. You know, beating around on him, wounding him. Having wounded him, ex ebalon, threw him out. All right? All followers of Velt's exegesis ought to be able to detect at this time that we've had ex apostello, ek balo. Probably that's the end of the sequence. And it is, because now is going to come sending the son, but the sequence of the slaves coming is now at an end. 13. Ipende, and the Lord of the vineyard said, Ti poieso, what shall I do? Now, I think that this is one of the rare instances of a first-person singular aorist subjunctive active, a deliberative subjunctive in the first singular, not the first plural. All right? Because normally the deliberative is first plural. What shall we do? Shall we sin that grace may abound? That's deliberative. See? But I think this is what this is. What shall I do? Unfortunately, it's in a weak verb, and you can't tell the difference between future indicative and aorist subjunctive in first singular. If we had a verb like balo, we'd be able to. So I would translate this, what shall I do, kind of thinking out loud. Now, pempso, they take as future indicative by the punctuation. I will send my son, the beloved one. Whoa, a little bit pregnant phraseology here. My beloved son. However, I would like to suggest that maybe we consider this to be something like cohortative. Let me. I think I'll. You know, let us go to the movies. Let's go to the movies. Let me send my son. I think I'll send my son. Let me send my son, the beloved. Issos means perhaps. Perhaps this one, entrape suntai, they will respect. That is actually a future passive form that is operates as a deponent, and it's entrepo. Entrepomai, and then that's the sixth principal part, entropane, entropesuntai, enetropane, rather. So, third person plural, future indicative passive. 14. But upon seeing him, the guy's name George, the farmers, di elogidzonta pros allelus legantas. They began to dialogue with themselves, saying, so they started a discussion. Houtas, this guy is the heir. Ap ektinomen auton. Now, there's a classic first person, plural, aorist, subjunctive, active, independent use of the subjunctive, cohortative, hortatory. Let us kill him. Come on, let's kill him. Let us, in the sense of let's. Let's kill him. Yeah, it could, in theory, be present, but it's probably aorist. Let's kill him in order that, now look what they say, hemon gene tai he kleronomia, in order that ours the inheritance might become. Not just the inheritance might become ours, but in order that ours the inheritance might become. Now, why did they say that? Why did they say that? Why would the inheritance be theirs if they killed the son? I mean, after all, if you're renting property from somebody and the son comes to collect the rent, if you kill him, you don't get the property. Ah, well, the reason is, if you look at Middle Eastern law, the reason is because in a rental situation with an absentee landlord, if for 3 straight years you did not collect rent, then you had a claim. I'm sorry, let me put it the other way. You're an absentee landlord. If you haven't collected for 3 years, the people have a claim against your property, kind of like by squatter's rights. The son coming is the guy who can show what the claim is and what the situation actually is. It's not so much that he's the heir, but that he is going to be able to expose and unmask the situation. If he can't do that, and they go into the fourth year and do not give the harvest, they're going to be able to get the property. So the Middle Eastern legalities of this are very important to understanding the parable. It's a classic interpreting on level two, because what we're doing here is we're interpreting the deeds of the story in context. 15. Kai ek balantus autan, and having thrown him out, exo, outside of the vineyard, ap ektainan, they killed what? Autan, him. See, the autan's in between there again. What therefore will to them the Lord of the vineyard do? Now, see, here's an example of where you kind of let the underwear show on the parable. You notice that he starts out by talking about anthropos. All right? And then it just talks about that the guy did the vineyard and he sent people and he sent other people and so on like that. And now, as it gets toward the end, in 13 and in 15, he's all of a sudden called the Kyrios of the vineyard, the Lord of the vineyard. And I think that's because, of course, in the interpretation, we're talking about the Lord of the people of Israel. So you can kind of see that interpretation showing through in the actual verbiage. 16. Eloisetai, he will come. Kai apolesai, he will destroy the farmers, these ones, and he will give the vineyard to others. Now, apolesai, third singular, future indicative active from apolemi, which is that old me verb where the actives are always transitive, meaning to destroy or possibly to lose. Eloisetai, third singular, future indicative middle from erchemai. Akousantes de aipan me genaita. And upon hearing it, they said, heck no! May it not be so. Hade, me genoita, third singular, aorist, optative, middle from ginomai. Who are the akousantes? They are the people, the crowds, the people. Notice ipon, by the way, third plural, aorist indicative active, weak aorist termination on a strong aorist stem. Hode, and he emblepsas autois ipen, and he, upon looking into them, said, ti un estin ta gegramenon tuta, gegramenon. Perfect passive participle from grapho. What is this thing which stands written? What is this having been written and standing written thing? Stone which apodokimazo. Dokimazo is to approve. Apodokimazo is to approve and throw away, to reject. Stone which they rejected after checking it out for approval. Hoi oikodomuntes, the builders. This one, egenethe, has become, Andy, has proved to be, has become unto, good Hebraic construction here, head of the corner, has proved to be the head of the corner. Note the word order here, the stone which the builders rejected. Now comes verse 18, which is the only gospel that has this one. Everyone pas ha peson, everyone who falls ep ekainon ton lithon upon that stone, sin thlas thesatai, will be crushed, will be well, it just means to crush, kind of like ba-boom, stuff falls on it. And upon whomever it falls, it will bruise him. Let me parse those two forms for you. Sin thlas thesatai is from thlao, sin thlao, which is to crush together with sin. And then likmao is to bruise or kind of beat upon something. And that's another a-o contract verb, likmao, likmeso. It will bruise him. Now, here again, we see a very important Lucan emphasis, namely that Jesus is central to the destiny of the nation. Jesus is central to the destiny of the nation. And it's not only does it have verse 17, but we have on here verse 18. This is the most important of all of Jesus' parables because it depicts the relationship between Jesus and the nation of Israel. Then verse 19. And etzete san hoi grammatais kai hoi archiereis, and sought the scribes and the chief priests, epibalein, to throw upon him the hands. Hey, get the hands out of the saddlebag there, boy. They always call it the hands instead of their hands. Their hands in the hour itself, in the very hour. And ephabethesan ton laon, and they feared the people for egnoson, third plural, aorist, indicative active from ginosko. They knew that toward against them he had spoken. Notice how I did that indirect discourse in a secondary sequence. They knew that he had spoken toward them, i.e. with them as a target, against them, this parable. Now, I think what's one of the things that you would want to emphasize if you're preaching on this as opposed to the other Gospels is, first of all, the centrality of Jesus in the destiny and that it's going to be a stumbling block. Secondly, the fact that the people are more involved here in Luke. It's not just like the other Gospels that he speaks to the other people first. He argues with them about the baptism of John, and then he just goes on and tells them another parable. The leaders, here, he specifically in verse 9, deals with the people, and note their response. This isn't in the other Gospels. Note their response in 16b. And they, upon hearing it, said, "Heck no, may it not be so." So the people themselves have a responsibility here to them. I think Luke's parable is in some ways more comfortable than the Matthean version, where you basically don't, well, how should I say this? It's much more focused on the leaders. Here the leaders and the people are obviously connected. See? They're obviously connected together. And the people are going to have responsibility for what happens vis-a-vis their leaders. Yes. Yes. No. The stone which the builders rejected. Yeah. Now I don't know. That's interesting. I don't know what the previous quote. And thank you. You've hit upon that. That would be, there is such a thing called assimilation of the antecedent, which is the reverse of the assimilation of the relative. Yeah, and that is the antecedent then goes to the hun because that's the object of apodokimazo there. Right, because the hutas, it really should be, you're right, it should be holithos, because it's going to be this one became the head of the corner. Right, right. Yeah, that's right. Very good, very good. Now, I'd like to see in the Septuagint what the previous verse is. to see if that's a kind of a continuation. But thank you. That's very good.
What's more positive, the crushing?
Neither is positive. Well, no, but remember, it's a different point. The first one is everyone who falls upon him, and then upon whomever he falls or it falls, it will bruise him. So I think basically what this is saying, I would take it like this. If you take offense, it's going to be bad for you. But even if you don't, so to speak, when the judgment comes on the nation, it's going to be bad. Thus, in 19, which is just the chapter before, there will not be left stone upon stone in your midst. You know, why? Because you did not know the time of your visitation, 1944. So I think what this is saying is, he is so central to the destiny of Israel that it doesn't even make any difference whether or not you have specifically rejected him the way the scribes and Pharisees have. You know, in a way, if you're just kind of neutral and you're not embracing him, it's still a bad deal for you. That's the way I would take it. Yeah, when he asks who, what'll happen, yeah. No, I don't think so, because in the story, as the story develops, I'm taking this up to verse 9. See, he began to say to the people this parable. And so he's talking about the people. And then, remember, he's the one who answers the question. He says, what will the Lord of the vineyard do? He will come and he will destroy these farmers and will give their vineyard to others. And upon hearing it, they said, heck no. So, I mean, if you're just reading the story, it's got to be the people he's talking to. Right. Well, I think you're infecting the story by reading Matthew. Don't do that. I mean, read the text what you got here.
Okay, but you also have to take into the context of the answer, that the parable is the answer to the question that the chief priest asked him originally. In other words, you can't just take just the parable, you have to go forward, you know, to the first part of the story where the chief priest, and they come to him. Mm-hmm. And then he says, well, who's according to John? And he's answering their question. He did not answer the question. He told the parable as he answered their question.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. However, it seems to me, though, as you read the story, though, that it's not apparent that when it says, upon hearing it, they said, may it not be, that the chief priests and the scribes would be answering that way. Heck, look at 19. They sought to kill him. See, in other words, that would be an awfully strange response for them to give in the middle of the story right there, which is kind of like me telling my family something and my boy says, oh, you mean we're not going? You know, something like that. You know, that's not the reaction of people who are going to kill him at this point. Well, anyway, I got to give Andy some time here. But let me just say, here's a good example of a parable, of why parables simply have to be, they're allegories and they got to be de-allegorized, right? The vineyard is Israel, God's pleasant planting, Isaiah 5:7. You got the son, you got the owner, the father, you got the leaders and everything. And, of course, where you're going to argue is this. Can I identify who three prophets are, or do I got to sit loose on some of the details? And I think the answer is you got to sit loose on some of the details. Because he's got to have three for the point about having possession of the vineyard. Okay. It seems to me that this is a very kind of Heilsgeschichte kind of thing. And so you're not, I would think that this is really quite improper if a guy's preaching this and all of a sudden the application is, if we don't take advantage of outreach in West County, God's going to withdraw his blessings from us, or something like that. No. I mean, this is really talking about the way God dealt historically, and the point is, it's a kingdom parable. So it's a parable where we're talking about Jesus and his ministry and how this works out, into the future and so forth, but it's talking about the rejection of that right there. Now, what I think would happen if you're preaching is I would emphasize the other side of it, namely the rejoicing that God keeps on saving, even though he's dealing with bozos. He keeps on saving, and so we are the beneficiaries and recipients of this blessing of giving the vineyard to others. See? Now, if you want to at some point quote 1 Peter and talk about judgment beginning in the household of God, I think you can. But if you're preaching this parable, I think that's the point you got to make historically.
I remember, gives this speech once that, frankly, some of these parables you just have to say don't have much to say today at this point. And I mean, the other trap would be to fall into is to kind of get on your let's blame the Jews, or this gives us a right to say why the Jews can't be part of the kingdom of God, and you sort of grind that axe.
But I do think, with this business about Jews and the kingdom, I do think that this parable, many of you who've had me for class know I've said this many times, this parable, I think, is the cause of the consternation in the early church about the salvation of the Jews. And the question is not, will all the Jews be saved? The question is, will any Jews be saved? Because Jesus told this parable. And so in Romans 9 to 11, especially in 11, Paul says, well, I agree for my brothers. And will the Jews be saved? He says, well, I myself am a Jew. See, he's not saying will everybody be saved, but some of them will be saved, but they must be re-engrafted. That's the answer.